This Family Life News podcast is made possible by the support of listeners like you.
It's the Noon Report from Family Life, bringing a Christian worldview to what's happening in New York, Pennsylvania, across the country, and around the world. Weather with Kevin Williams, plus special features and reports with the Family Life News team. Now, here's what's happening.
Hello again. Welcome to the broadcast. It may be spring, but old man winter is hanging tough. April showers have given way to a nasty nor'easter that is clobbering New England today. Ben Walker in Boston says it's a hold on to your hat sort of day.
It's just a mess here. High winds are causing windswift rains, and we're getting gusts up to 50 miles an hour.
The state of Maine could get 2 feet of snow before this day is done. Meteorologist Janice Dean.
Over the next few days, actually, we're going to see lake effect snow through Saturday. The jackpot, as we say, will be in Maine. Yes, sometimes in April, they get a lot of snow.
Accumulating snow possible as well on the higher hilltops north of the New York State Thruway. In fact, there's a winter storm warning in effect until tomorrow morning in the Mohawk Valley. For everyone else, says Spectrum News meteorologist Todd Kirkman.
We're going to find off and on snow and rain showers as we go through the next few days, really right through Saturday.
Nothing that'll stick, says Kirkman, but it stays cold right through Saturday, and that wind chill will make it feel even colder. Wind whipped rain on Wednesday knocked out power to tens of thousands in New York and Pennsylvania. Reporter Dave Malkoff says several tornadoes touched down in the Ohio Valley.
You kind of think of tornadoes classically as being in Tornado Alley, maybe in Oklahoma or something like that. But there is a shift that's happening where tornadoes are shifting east.
In Pennsylvania, an 82-year-old woman died when a tree fell on her car in the town of Collegeville. That's a suburb of Philadelphia. Biden and Bibi, that's the other big story we're following today. President Biden and Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu talk shop on the telephone today. Reporter Jared Helpburn.
The conversation between the president and prime minister will be the first since an Israeli airstrike killed several humanitarian aid workers this week in Gaza. The president described outrage over the incident. White House National Security Communications Advisor John Kirby says that does not signal a shift in U.S. support for Israel.
We are working very closely with them. We will continue to work closely with them to make sure they can defend themselves, but also that they do it in a way that is in keeping with the highest standards of the law of armed conflict.
President Biden has warned Netanyahu against a ground invasion of Rafah in southern Gaza, where more than a million civilians are seeking refuge.
Correspondent Nancy Cordes at the White House says this errant strike has thrown another monkey wrench into already strained relations between the U.S. and Israel.
Democrats in particular have been growing angrier over Israel's conduct in this war, particularly after this most recent tragedy. So could it make it more difficult to get aid to Israel through Congress, through the House and the Senate? It absolutely could.
Despite the growing rift between Washington and Tel Aviv, the Biden administration's requesting Congress approve another $18 billion military aid package for Israel. Emergency crews are still trying to reach hundreds in need of rescue. After a major earthquake rocked Taiwan, nearly 700 are believed to be stranded in hard-hit areas. Reporter Janice Mackey Frayer.
Today across Taiwan, a search for people trapped or missing. Some buildings so damaged they're at risk of falling over. Helicopters rescuing remote quarry workers, but dozens remain stranded. The magnitude 7.4 quake made roads buckle and houses crumble.
Wednesday's earthquake was the worst in Taiwan in 25 years. Stormy weather affecting salvage efforts at the site of the Key Bridge collapse in Baltimore. Colonel Este Pinchasin with the Army Corps of Engineers says there's almost zero visibility underwater.
Divers are working basically in darkness because if they used lights, if we lit it up, it would be like they were driving through a snowstorm with their high beams on.
Crane operators have been suspended because of severe thunderstorms and high winds. Temporary shipping routes have opened up in the port of Baltimore following that deadly bridge cargo ship collision last week. Vice President Harris is trying to drum up support among the youth vote with a campaign stop in North Carolina today. A recent Wall Street Journal poll has Donald Trump up 6 points on President Biden in the Tar Heel State.
You see so many young people fleeing the Democratic Party in droves. And keep in mind, this is a demographic that turned out overwhelmingly for Biden back in 2020.
Kaylee McGee-White with the Washington Examiner says there's been a 7-point swing Donald Trump's way when it comes to the youth vote in 2024.
I don't know if it necessarily translates for a massive youth turnout in Trump's favor in November. What I think is much more likely is that a lot of young adults are simply not going to vote at all.
A recent Axios poll finds 58% of younger voters plan to sit out the 2024 election. Anticipation is growing for Monday's total solar eclipse. Janet Shamlian reports from a prime viewing place.
In the scenic Texas Hill Country, Kerrville is preparing for its moment in the sun, the blocked sun.
How ready is Kerrville?
Absolutely ready. We've been getting ready for 2 years.
Mayor Judy Eichner says a city of about 25,000 could swell to as many as 100,000.
We will have one-way traffic right up here along this bridge.
So you're changing the traffic flow of the city?
Absolutely.
Kerrville will have one of the nation's longest views of the moon obscuring the sun at 4 minutes, 25 seconds.
Should be quite a show. That's Janet Shamlian in Kerrville, Texas today. Still to come on the Noon Report. Crime and punishment, bills, trade digs, and path of totality.
Good afternoon. I'm Kevin Williams, tracking low pressure set to deliver more snow and rain to our region over the next 24 hours. I'll have forecast details coming up in 10 minutes.
All right, Kevin, we'll see you then. Interstate 90 is reopened again after a fatal crash last night in Buffalo. One person was killed in the tractor-trailer rollover. Happened around 8:30 in the evening near Exit 51. The driver was the sole occupant of the big rig and was pronounced while being transported to the hospital. Buffalonians cannot stop talking about it. The Bills' decision to trade Pro Bowl wide receiver Stephon Diggs to the Houston Texans. Bills GM Brandon Bean.
You weigh the pros and the cons of every decision like this, and we don't take it lightly, but you're always making it in the best interest of the Bills.
Still, some members of Bills Mafia are having trouble coming to terms with the trade.
It's not right. It's just not right. Stephon and Josh, they're the best tag team. Josh and Stephon is like Jerry Rice and Joe Montana.
But others say they're glad to see Diggs go.
There seemed to be a lot of drama in the last year surrounding him, and his production had declined a lot. So where there's smoke, there's fire. That's what they say.
The Bills get a second-round draft pick for giving up Diggs. The 30-year-old played 4 seasons in Buffalo. Pennsylvania's rolling out redesigned mail-in ballots for the April 23rd primary election. All 67 counties will use them. Bethany Salzarulo with the Cumberland County Board of Elections.
The Department of State decided to make counties uniformed in how the ballot envelopes will look for the mail-in and absentee ballots.
More from reporter Evan Popoulos with ABC 27.
Commonwealth Secretary Al Schmidt says, quote, in each election cycle since 2020, when no excuse mail-in voting was implemented in Pennsylvania, we have seen thousands of mail-in ballots not be counted because of unintended technical errors voters made when completing their ballot. Before, counties printed their own envelopes and ballots, but misprints and confusing instructions led to mistake-filled envelopes.
The Third Circuit Court of Appeals recently ruled that ballots with the wrong date or no date will not count. Dan Barkowiak with the Pennsylvania Family Institute.
It may certainly have some implications when it comes to the upcoming elections. I think particularly maybe the smaller races like state House, state Senate races. But ultimately, the law was written. Legislature requiring a signature, dating requirements. From a court perspective, they shouldn't be rewriting law. It's enforcing that law.
More than 800,000 mail-in ballots have been requested for the April primary, and just in time for the April primary, there's a new online voter guide from the Pennsylvania Family Institute. You can get yours at pafamilyvoter.com. Criminal justice reform is a cantankerous issue in the ongoing ongoing New York budget talks. The spending plan is late again this year as state lawmakers debate public safety. Activists argue New York's lax bail laws have led to a crime crisis in the Empire State.
It's time we get back to taking care of the victims of crime. Right? That's what we have to get back to.
Republicans and law enforcement officials are pushing for legislation that would increase penalties for repeat offenders. They also want mandatory life sentences or the death penalty for cop killers. Governor Hochul continues to defend her record on crime.
All I know is that violent crimes are down 30%. Recidivism is down 40%.
The governor was denied entry into the wake last week of a New York City cop who was killed in the line of duty. Family members didn't want her there because of New York's soft-on-crime policies. Assembly Speaker Carl Hastie says he won't apologize for his controversial stance when it comes to criminal justice reform.
No, I don't believe in the history of increasing penalties. Has that ever been the reason why crime has gone down? Other things happening is why crime goes down.
The state assembly recently rejected the governor's proposal to make assaulting a retail worker a felony. A bill advancing in the state house in Harrisburg requires so-called dark money groups disclose how they spend that cash on elections. Another bill would force candidates to more frequently disclose which people or groups donate to their campaigns. Supporters argue improved transparency is good for democracy, but opponents call the legislation an infringement on the First Amendment. A new map for the path of totality for next Monday's eclipse shows that path of totality may be narrower than previously thought. Meteorologist John DePasquale.
Scientists miscalculated the size of the sun by a little bit, and that little bit of miscalculation has caused the path of totality to narrow a bit. Very subtle, but a little bit. Shifting the southern edge to the north by, yes, 0.4 miles.
For folks in the southern part of New York's Finger Lakes region, they may have to move a bit further north for optimum viewing. In the Syracuse area, communities now out of the path of totality include Marietta, Owosco, Dresden, the southern half of Penn Yan, and a large portion of the city of Rome. DePasquale says there's a big difference between totality and near totality.
The difference is huge. 99% of coverage of the sun. It's still going to be kind of daylight and just a kind of a diminishing of the colors, but still light. Whereas totality, it's going to be almost completely dark with some twilight around the horizon.
Clouds are in the forecast for Monday, but it should not dampen the eclipse experience. The next total solar eclipse won't happen until 2044. A Senate panel in Harrisburg is holding a hearing this afternoon on whether to delay the start of the school day. There's a bill in the state Senate that bans districts from starting school any earlier than 8:15 a.m. Today's hearing starts at 1 p.m. and will be live streamed on the Senate website. The conclusion of the high school basketball season has reignited an age-old debate about fairness in sports in Pennsylvania. Family Life's Brian Querry.
The system for crowning champions used by the Pennsylvania Interscholastic Athletic Association is being challenged by lawmakers. At the moment, public and private schools compete for the same trophies, but some lawmakers are looking to change this. Center County Representative Scott Conklin is the primary sponsor for a bill he says will make the postseason fairer by giving boundary schools and non-boundary schools their own separate tournaments.
Well, when you have one school that's able to recruit young people from around the world, and you have another school that has to stay within the boundary, it's not teaching children fairness. It's teaching them that you can buy a title.
The bill has been referred to the House Education Committee for consideration. Brian Querry, Family Life News.
Thank you, Brian. Many public schools argue that since private schools can recruit student athletes from multiple districts, that gives them a distinct advantage. The two-minute drill next in sports on the Family Life Noon Report.
Good afternoon, I'm Randy Snavely. Bob the Stunner out of Buffalo. Is the trading of wide receiver Stephon Diggs. The Bills are sending Diggs and two later round draft picks to Houston in exchange for a 2025 second round pick. Diggs just 5 yards shy of 10,000 receiving yards for his career. at the Garden last night. The gloves came off just 2 seconds into the game as a brawl broke out between the Rangers and the Devils. 8 players were ejected. Then they played some hockey. New York took a 2-0 lead in the first on goals by Panarin and Lafreniere, but New Jersey took a 3-2 lead after two. Kaapo Kakko evened things up in the third, and then Chris Kreider scored the game winner on a power play goal with just under 5 minutes to play, 4-3 for the Blue Shirts. The Stars, Kings, Lightning, and Canucks also won. In the NBA, the Nets split their home-and-home against the Pacers with a 115-111 victory. Cam Thomas led the way with 27 points. Malachi Flynn, he is a reserve guard for the Detroit Pistons. Well, last night, he came off the bench in Atlanta and scored 50 points. That's a franchise record for a bench player for Detroit. But the Pistons fell to the Hawks in the game, 121-113. The Lakers, Celtics, T-Wolves, Grizzlies, Magic, Suns, and Trailblazers also picked up wins. To baseball, Aaron Judge had an RBI double in the 11th inning, and the Yankees won the rubber game of their series with the D-backs, 6-5 the final. Pirates lost their first game of the season, 5-3 to the Nationals. The Phillies fell to the Reds, 4-1. Elsewhere, the Red Sox, Astros, Guardians, Rangers, Orioles, Cubs, Angels, Dodgers, and Twins all won. That is a look at sports.
Thank you, Randy. Still to come, violence at church, Biden and Bibi, and when elephants attack.
Welcome to Breakpoint, a daily look at an ever-changing culture through the lens of unchanging truth. For the Colson Center, I'm John Stone Street. On Easter Day, April the 4th, 1523, Leonard Kopp smuggled a group of nuns that were hiding in barrels full of herring out of a convent in Nipschen. One of the nuns was Katharina von Bora, who later became the wife of Martin Luther. Katharina had lived in convents since she was very young, placed there by her parents, who were too poor to supply her dowry. Unhappy there, Katharina found both the opportunity and the inspiration to escape when the Protestant Reformation began to spread. She and several other nuns secretly contacted Martin Luther and asked for help to escape the monastery. Luther obliged. At first, Luther and Kopp attempted to convince the nuns' families to take them back, but the families refused, possibly because it was against the law to take in an escaped nun. Instead, they found employment for as many of the nuns as possible, but several others were married off to students training for the pastorate. After 2 years, only Katharina remained. After neither of the two potential marriages that had been arranged for her worked out, she told Nicholas von Amsdorf, Luther's friend and co-worker, that she would only marry either him or Martin Luther, no one else. Luther was reluctant to marry. After all, he'd been declared an imperial outlaw at the Diet of Worms, so anyone who found him could legally kill him. Understandably, he expected his life to end burned at the stake as a heretic. Nonetheless, he eventually agreed to marry Katharina in a small private ceremony held on June the 13th, 1525. He was 41, she was 26. The Luthers moved into the Black Cloister, a former Augustinian monastery and dormitory for students at the University of Wittenberg. The newly married Katharina was no wilting flower, even in the face of her world-altering husband. She immediately took over the household, running the Black Cloister and caring for the 30 or so students and guests who lived there as boarders. She grew crops, she kept farm animals, she brewed beer on the side, all while serving her community as a part-time nurse and raising her own 6 children and 4 other orphans. She would have put any of today's Instagram hipper homesteaders to shame. While the marriage didn't begin as a standard love match, a true romance of mutual respect and affection soon grew between Martin and Katharina. At times, Martin would consult her on church matters and allow her to deal with his publishers. Because she oversaw the household the way she did, Martin could devote all of his time to the church and to the university. He developed a deep, sincere respect for his wife, and he loved her deeply. He often referred to her as Katie My Rib, or the Morning Star of Wittenberg, due to her habit of rising at 4 in the morning to get all of her work done. And she called Martin Herr Doctor throughout her life. Martin urged Katie to sell the cloister and move into a smaller house after he died, but she refused, perhaps because so much of her life and love were found there. But his advice unfortunately proved accurate. Katie was forced to flee Wittenberg twice during a brief war, and when she returned, the cloister and the farms had been devastated. Had she sold the property earlier, she'd been financially stable, but instead she was now forced to move out of the cloister and became financially destitute. Only the generosity of Elector John Frederick kept the family alive. In 1552, plague broke out in Wittenberg. Katerina left the city for Torgau, where her cart had an accident that left her seriously injured. She died there 3 months later, on December the 20th, 1552. She was 53. She is reported to have said on her deathbed, quote, "I will stick to Christ as a burr to cloth." She was buried there in Torgau, far from her beloved husband. For the Colson Center, I'm John Stone Street.
All right, John, thank you. Outside next, Kevin Williams.
Here is your family life weather forecast for this afternoon. Cloudy with occasional snow and rain. Little to no accumulation for most. Temperatures holding nearly steady. Tonight, cloudy with periods of snow mixed with rain early. And there could be a coating to an inch in some areas and a couple 3 inches over some of the highest elevations. Low temps dropping toward 30. Tomorrow, a couple of rain and snow showers. High temps near 40. And on Saturday, mostly cloudy with a shower and a high temperature in the 40s.
All right, Kevin, thank you. This is the Noon Report. I'm your host, Bob Price. Here's what's happening Thursday, April 4th. At least three deaths blamed on the storms this week that blew through. Meteorologist Angie Lassman.
We've got 8 million people still under these winter alerts. Much of it, of course, is across parts of New England, including folks that are dealing with not just the wintry weather and even the rain, but the potential for some really strong winds. We've got 5 million people under these wind alerts at this time.
Two were killed by falling trees in Pennsylvania. Another died in a storm-related car wreck in Kentucky. Airports up and down the Atlantic seaboard extra busy today due to a combination of factors: the wicked weather, spring break, and of course, Monday's eclipse. Correspondent Tom Costello.
The peak of spring break travel expected to culminate today, with many Americans looking for a different kind of sun worship.
It's sort of a perfect storm.
Communities along the path of the eclipse totality now getting ready to welcome visitors for Monday's solar eclipse.
Up to 1 million out-of-towners expected to flock to western New York to see the eclipse. Hotels are booked solid. Schools and businesses are closing early on Monday for the celestial light show. The head of an international aid group is accusing Israel of intentionally killing 7 volunteers during that airstrike in Gaza this week. Celebrity chef Jose Andres with World Central Kitchen.
So this was not just a bad luck situation where, oops, we dropped the bomb in the wrong place, but we need to know the truth.
Israel calls the errant strike a horrible accident. The incidents caused a rift in the already souring U.S.-Israeli relationship. Reporter Weijia Jang has more from the White House.
President Biden has grown increasingly critical of Israel's military strategy. Biden said Israel has not done enough to protect aid workers or to spare civilian lives. Last week, the administration did not veto a UN Security Council resolution calling for a ceasefire in Gaza, as it had done before, which angered Netanyahu so much he canceled a meeting between his top aides and U.S. officials about a full-scale invasion into the city of Rafah.
President Biden talks on the telephone today with Israel's prime minister. Earthquake relief efforts continue in Taiwan.
Over 1,000 have been injured, while more than 100 are still missing, many among the island's mountains. Up a remote valley, a drone discovered miners stuck on a cliff. Landslides wiped out all the roads.
Correspondent Ian Lee, an elephant charged a group of tourists on safari in Africa over the weekend. The pachyderm charged at the sightseers, flipping over their vehicle and killing a U.S. citizen. It happened at a national park in Zambia. A 79-year-old Minnesota woman died. A man who survived a medical first has just been released from the hospital.
Rick Slayman, who received the world's first genetically modified pig kidney transplant last month, was discharged from a Boston hospital to recover at home. In a statement, Slayman said leaving the hospital was one of the happiest moments of his life.
Correspondent Chanel Call. A homeschooling mom from Texas received an arrest warrant this week after she failed to return a library book on time. Kaylee Morgan found out about it when she went to renew her driver's license.
And when I get there, they tell me that they cannot renew my driver's license because I have a warrant out for my arrest.
Morgan had to pay a $570 fine. She says she did not return the book when it was due to complications with her pregnancy. The 2024 UConn men's basketball team is on cruise control when it comes to the March Madness tournament.
Back to the Final Four to defend their title.
But the Huskies have not had nearly as easy a time of it when it comes to departing the airport. Their plane was delayed by several hours Wednesday and only arrived this morning in Phoenix, Arizona, where the Final Four will happen on Saturday. Both the UConn men and women are competing in this year's Final Four. So too are the men and women for NC State. Go Wolfpack. This is the Noon Report on Family Life.
It's time for Faith Under Fire, the Family Life news feature that gives voice to religious battlegrounds. This week, literal battlegrounds, violence and threats against congregations. I'm Greg Gillespie, and today we talk with Ariel Del Turco, who leads the Center for Religious Liberty, which has published a report on the violence facing churches. Across 6 years, those numbers have expanded. Ariel, what are the trends you're seeing from this latest report?
Yeah, Family Research Council has been studying what we call acts of hostility against churches over the past 6 years. So that includes vandalism, bomb threats, arson, gun-related incidents, and really any type of crime that takes place on church property. Over those 6 years, we've sadly seen a huge increase in the amount of acts of hostility that are being committed against churches in the United States. Our numbers most recently from last year in 2023, we identified 436 acts of hostility against churches, and that was more than double the previous year. So we're seeing a sharp increase in recent years, and we think that's very concerning for anyone who cares about religious freedom.
On one level, 400 compared to the number of worship services that happen week by week, you're safe going to churches, but at the same time, if the rate of violence has doubled in the last year, that really is something that people need to be attentive to. What's been the reaction to your research?
I think people are very surprised to see this. We don't see it covered in the news media a whole lot, and I think that's partly because it doesn't fit some of the mainstream media's narratives that they want to push out. They might want to focus on other minorities, other religious groups, other non-religious groups, and they just really overlook some of the rising hostility that's taking place against Christianity. And you're exactly right that these numbers aren't earth-shattering. However, they really represent the tip of the iceberg. These are just the acts that are publicly recorded in news or police reports that are publicly available. So we think this represents a much larger problem underneath the surface.
So these incidents that you are counting are the ones that are acts of violence. Law enforcement gets involved. That is separate from anybody that comes in and gets into a shouting match or anything. But are there trends that we can picture and connect those dots?
Yeah, it's hard to totally quantify what's happening in the hearts of men in these situations. However, we do notice certain trends politically, that there seems to be some political motivation, especially around the issue of abortion. So after the Supreme Court leaked its Dobbs decision, which of course was eventually released and overturned Roe v. Wade, we saw a spike in violence against churches, not only generally, but specifically violence that nasty threats written on the front of church buildings, talking about the church's pro-life stance. But I think on a larger scale, it's just a collapse of societal respect for churches that is enabling this rise in vandalism against churches. I don't think we would have seen this on this scale a few decades ago even. And I think it goes to show where our culture is. We're living in an increasingly secular society that doesn't understand religion and doesn't, therefore, respect religion. And the fact that people can walk past a church and throw a brick in a stained glass window at minimum, or behead statues outside of churches, or worse, set a church on fire. The churches have really become a platform for people to express their rage, and I think that's really dangerous.
In some ways, again, this is a political or a cultural leaning, theological leaning question. Shouldn't all churches speak out against all violence against all churches?
This is actually an issue that can unify churches along denominations, across the political spectrum, all Christians and all people of faith should be able to say that it's totally unacceptable for these crimes to be occurring against Christians and against churches. We don't want any religious community to feel that they are being targeted in their community, that they are under threat, that their church is unwanted. I think this is an issue that transcends some of these political boundaries and even religious boundaries. This is something that I think all religious adherents can agree on.
Ariel Del Turco directs the Center for Religious Liberty, a ministry of the Family Research Council. Their report on threats and violence, the dangers for churches, is available on their website. We link to it from familylife.org. I'm Greg Gillespie. This is Faith Under Fire from Family Life News.
All right, Greg, thank you very much. Faith Under Fire airs Thursdays during the Noon Report or online anytime at familylife.org.
Good afternoon. Here is your Family Life regional weather forecast. Low pressure tracking into New England will result in more inclement weather here this afternoon, tonight, into tomorrow with some snow and rain at times. The system's departure will mean improving weather this weekend. We should be back to some fairer skies and milder conditions beginning Sunday and lasting into early next week, hopefully to include conditions for the eclipse. But in the meantime, for this afternoon, cloudy with occasional snow and rain. Little to no accumulation for most. Temperatures holding nearly steady. Tonight, cloudy with periods of snow mixed with rain early. And there could be a coating to an inch in some areas and a couple 3 inches over some of the highest elevations. Low temps dropping toward 30. Tomorrow, a couple of rain and snow showers. High temps near 40. And on Saturday, mostly cloudy with a shower and a high temperature in the 40s.
All right, Kevin, thank you. And finally at noon, you may be excited about Monday's eclipse. Who wouldn't be? But probably not as excited as Laverne Beiser of Fort Worth, Texas. He lives for eclipses. He's also lived for 105 years, so he's seen a lot of them.
I've seen 12 of them. This will be my 13th. It's a fantastic thing to see. The first one was Dover Foxtrot, Maine. I drove up there to see that. You see one, you want to see them all. And everybody yells, hey, look at that. If it stays clear, you just keep watching it. Use your glasses when it's partial eclipse, but when it's total, take those up and look at it. It's beautiful to see. It excites you.
Beiser's traveled as far away as Brazil to make sure he gets the best view for an eclipse. This time, however, he gets to take it easy and watch number 13 right from his own backyard. That's where I plan to watch it as well. Hopefully the weather will cooperate. And that's the world we live in, folks. Thursday, April 4th. I'm Bob Price. Family Life News.
You've been listening to the Noon Report, heard weekdays on Family Life. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening to this Family Life News podcast. If you've been encouraged by what you've heard, please share it with others and click the subscribe button to automatically receive future episodes. Family Life is a listener-supported ministry. Podcasts like this are made possible by your financial partnership. Find out more at familylife.org.